Welcome to the American Classroom Podcast, where we discuss the role of education in building a civil society. I'm Jared Taylor. I'm here with my co-host, Lindsay Croslin.
Good morning.
How are you doing today, Lindsay?
Doing great. Excited to talk about school choice.
Yeah. And we've got Jenny Clark as our special guest today. Looking forward to talking with you, Jenny.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Well, let's begin. Well, Jenny, let's just start by our listeners listening a little bit about you. And why don't you tell us about your background and why education?
Why education? Such a good question. Well, I am an Arizona native. I was born and raised here. I actually went to public school. I have five children. And I just assumed that, my kids would go to public school like I did and had a good experience there. But very early on, I decided that I wanted to try my hand at homeschooling. And when my oldest son was six, he's now 14, we discovered that he wasn't learning so well. He was really struggling to learn to read. And we ended up going through a very long, difficult, lengthy process of getting both of our boys at the time diagnosed with dyslexia. So that process was really difficult and overwhelming and frustrating. It's why I have such a heart for students with disabilities, and it flows into my work with my nonprofit, Love Your School. But we started needing to look at different education options, which meant we ended up in this crazy world of empowerment scholarship accounts, or ESAs, and school choice. So I kind of got into this whole education world by accident through my own children, which I think is a story that's very similar to a lot of parents I talk to. Thank you.
No, that's great. Jenny is also a member of the Arizona State Board of Education. So how many years have you been on the state board so far?
2 years on the State Board of Education. And by the time I finish, it will have been a little over 2.5.
Oh, wow. Okay, good. And thank you for serving.
Thank you.
That's a big deal. I know. I was there a little bit before you for about 4 years. And for the listeners that don't know about the Arizona State Board, every state has a State Board of Education, and they are the governing board for the K-12 system in the particular state that they're in. So Arizona, roughly 1.1 million in the system still. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's about right. And it's been a really amazing experience for me to learn about what's happening in Arizona public schools, how I can advocate as a public member. Of course, it's a constitutional board. I serve as one of the public members. And I've been very excited to advocate for ESA families, because the state board now does oversee certain aspects of the ESA program.
Right. Yeah.
And also to be an advocate for public school students with disabilities. So we've got some good things happening there.
Good for you. Thanks for being involved. And you're a great example of what I think is really one of the pillars of American education, is the parent's role in taking and leading and guiding the education of their children. That is a unique concept in the world, if you think about that.
It is a unique concept. And it's really interesting, because the system is often set up to discourage that parental involvement. And I saw that firsthand going through the special education evaluation process in the public district school. And you really get made to feel at every turn that you are wrong for asking questions, that you don't actually know what's best for your children. So I'm looking forward to digging into some of that, because I think what you guys are doing with this podcast and the opportunities we have to empower parents in their child's education are really where we need to be headed.
Well, and it's a big deal when you come talk about school choice. There's definitely people in the district public school system that bristle. Mm-hmm. But my time on the state board and working with a lot of great superintendents, I realized what I knew, and you know, which is there's a lot of great teachers and principals and school leaders in the district public school system. They're in it for the right reasons, doing great work. And it's a pleasure to get to know them on a deeper level, on a policy level, and support a lot of their great things.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think it's very easy for people to vilify the entire system. But just like you said, I have met so many educators that are going, hey, I see where things are going and I don't like it. How can I make a change even from the inside? So it's really great you point that out.
We're going to tell a lot of stories about school choice, and we're going to get to ESAs in a minute. We want to start a little bit background, but I'll tell you, when Diane and I were choosing our schools, we looked at all of the test scores. We did start there, I'm not going to lie. Probably not the best place to do it, but we also knew the culture and we knew some of the systems. We liked the traditional classical model. And there was a pretty good charter school right next to our neighborhood. But you know what? They didn't perform as well as the district school. And so our children went to district schools and they had a great time. They had great teachers that loved them. And for us, that's what school choice meant. A lot of times people think school choice and they think non-district schools. But the truth is sometimes those are the right choices for parents when they make that.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly right. And that's why even at Love Your School, our whole focus is what is best for the child and helping the parents know what their options are.
Yeah.
There's, which we're going to talk about, that kind of idea that, well, if you love and support school choice, district, homeschool, ESA programs, whatever it is, that means that you're automatically against your locally zoned district school.
Right.
And that is just not the case at all. And we have to work really hard to remind parents, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about parental empowerment.
Yeah. No, that's good. Anything you want to add before we dig into a few things here?
I'm just grateful to live in a state that has these options because I see my sister in San Francisco, and I don't know the exact number, but I'm pretty sure when her kids were going to school, this is like in the K-8 space, she had to put top 14 schools that were in her choice.
Oh, interesting.
There's no public transportation. And you get sent to whatever, and it's not always sibling matched. So she, she delivers babies in a town outside of San Francisco, and yet she needed to do like an Uber situation and Subway kids, not called the tram in San Francisco to get her kids to school. And I was just feeling so grateful that I could choose the school down the street, or I can drive them 30 minutes, 40 minutes, however long I want to get them to the school I feel like is best for them. And I wasn't subject to just some sort of lottery for the entire state, it felt like.
Wow.
Yeah, some people will disparage Arizona as the Wild West or we have too much choice. Once you get in the system and you start understanding it, then parents really change that mindset if they are thinking that this is too confusing, right? They're like, oh, wow, this is great. I can choose, you know, the school that fits best for my children. Jenny, let's start big picture here a little bit. What do you see as the state of school choice in the U.S.? And then maybe bring it down to Arizona from your position on the state board.
Well, the state of school choice in the U.S. right now, and if people are listening, maybe they can tell by my voice because I'm smiling, is pretty amazing and is going in a pretty incredible direction. I think that in 2020, so many parents realized that their kids needed something different. A lot of parents, you know, woke up, for lack of a better term, in various different ways to what was maybe happening in their child's education, either that they didn't like or they felt like didn't work for them. And that was really the start of what we saw first in Arizona and then West Virginia and then Florida, the first few states to get universal ESAs. To this kind of second wave of school choice from charters to now directly empowering parents with their child's education dollars through what we call education savings accounts. So we saw Arizona in 2022. And now, if you can believe it, in 2024, we are up to 13 states.
Wow.
With some sort of ESA program. Not all of those states are universal. Some of those states have, year one, it's only this percentage of families that are low income, or it could be families that are, you know, meeting some sort of other statutory requirement. And some of those programs slowly open up to more families over the years. We've got a few more states, I think, this year too, that we're going to see pass universal ESA programs. Just this week, we saw Alabama. And that's going to be getting signed.
Oh, wow.
Wyoming, Georgia, I think a few other states we're going to see this year. Texas, yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah, it's interesting you say the second wave, right? Because this year is actually the 30th anniversary of when Governor Simonton in Arizona signed charter legislation.
Wow.
Pretty amazing. And then next year was the first operating year for charter schools. And that really was a huge push into school choice, and that's here to stay. And I think maybe like ESAs, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but charter schools really started from dissatisfaction of inner cities. I mean, the old waiting for Supermans or in D.C. and those districts, or trying to rebuild, New Orleans?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that it was perfectly clean in every single circumstance. There's some mess, you know, when it comes to freedom, but the return from those investments from those communities typically starts in benefiting the most distressed families and communities, and then the wave just goes out. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And starts with the parents in those communities, essentially saying, what we've got over here isn't working, and why can't we have what's happening over there? And I think when we look even at Arizona, with our testing, with our scores, with our reading, I'm like, there's been incredible gains in Arizona on like the nation's report card. We still got a long way to go, but there's been incredible gains in Arizona because of our school choice environment. And so I think parents are starting to say, hey, why in Arizona, if I don't like my locally zoned district school, can I open enroll or go to a charter school or take an ESA to a private school or home educate with it, but I can't do that in my state? And so we're seeing parents start to demand in other states that we never thought we would see school choice, that parental empowerment piece, because they just want what's best for their kids. And that's essentially where a lot of the charter school movement started as well. I remember that because I was in high school at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And we had kids that were going to leave our public high district high school to try this new charter thing. It's just crazy how time flies.
I have some of the early press releases of my father and this risky school choice, and who knows what's going on. That was the narrative early on.
Yep.
It was amazing. But
it's a free market approach, though, which I know we're going to delve into also. It's like the market wants, parents being the market, they want freedom. They want options. They want choices. And we saw that with the charter school movement, and now we're seeing it with ESAs.
Humans want choices.
That's right.
We're all created equal in the eyes of God, that's for sure. And right, and where our rights come from. But students
have different needs. Yeah. And so if you just have one school for the entire town or city, mm-hmm. that might not be the best fit for your particular child.
And I've seen some districts early on, they bristled and they fought and they sent their lobbyists down to try to kill it. And the other districts, I'll call out Chandler Unified School District, because they said, okay, if choice is the new game, then we're going to go compete and we're going to win. And it's really interesting to hear Dr. Camille Castile. It was a great superintendent, a great school leader there for many, many years, and just retired. And she helped shape that board's attitude of, well, we're going to compete and we're going to win. And what they found in their district is that they had less saturation of charters in their district because they gave parents better choices. And they were one of the first districts in Arizona to really start to diversify their portfolio of high schools.
Wow.
And specialize in different programs in their elementary schools as well. Well, I think one of the big takeaways is districts are choices. I don't know why they don't think that they're a choice. And they can be the best choice, like Chandler Unified decided to be, whereas other districts decided to just fight about it and complain about it and not do anything. And the parents just kind of drifted away.
That's a great example comes to mind about a school district in Arizona, Paradise Valley Unified. And there's some schools that are closing there. And that's the district I went to growing up. It's a district that we live in and border on. And, you know, I don't think it's wrong to talk about this. I think that it's important. There's this conversation around, well, it's school choice is actually, you know, the problem with why these, you know, schools are closing. Never mind, the reality is demographics. But the other really interesting thing, when you look at some of these districts that are losing students, where are they losing them to? And in Paradise Valley Unified, thankfully, we do have the numbers. They're losing them to Scottsdale Unified, because Scottsdale Unified is competing for those students. And the number of students actually that have gone to Scottsdale Unified is higher than the number of families that have left for an ESA. And so some people might say, well, it's tragic what's happening over there. And I would say it's never tragic when a parent is empowered to make a decision and put their child somewhere that works for them. They're no longer trapped. That's a good thing. Yeah.
There's a little game I teach in an economics class, and you take brown bags and you put candy in it, just an assortment of candy, like Halloween kind of candy, right? And you tell everyone, you pair up two people in, and then you say, hey, look at your bag and trade with that person the candy you don't like and see if you can get candy you do like. And at the very beginning, before we even do the trading, we score it, and they score like how much did they like their current bag of candy. And then after every round, after you trade, then you score it again and it gets a little higher. And then you combine four and you trade more and it gets a little higher. And it just shows that power of choice, because at the very end, when everybody's trading with everybody in this big chaos, then they have the maximum
satisfaction.
What am I saying? Satisfaction. Thank you. Of it is because they have the most choice. And it's a fundamental principle of nature here that when people have choices, their satisfaction level goes up because they're going to choose the things in the best interest of their family.
Well, and it brings up a good kind of principle too about voluntary exchange. People don't make choices. Like you can't be forced into make a choice to do the trade, right? You're saying it benefits me and it benefits you. I want to engage in that trade. And that's what I love so much about the empowerment that comes from the school choice movement, from charters, from private schools, ESAs, tax credit scholarships, is that you're empowering people to make choices that benefit them on both sides.
Right. And some people will point to ESAs or charters as people that are, that's where all the districts are losing their populations to. When we built a school in the city of Maricopa, we did a lot of research and we found that there were 5 busloads of students that were leaving. And do you think they were going to charters? No. Those 5 busloads were leaving Maricopa Unified School District, which is a city outside of the Phoenix Metro for those listening outside of Arizona. They were going to other district schools. They were not going to charter schools. They were going to in Tempe.
Higher performing.
Yep.
Yeah, or better athletics.
Yep.
I mean, there was a million different reasons, but by far and away, more people leave districts to go to other districts than go to charters. That's one thing people don't want to admit, but it's the truth about school choice.
Well, and on this note, there's some really neat stuff happening on the open enrollment district boundary line issue. There's a national movement, and that Love Your School's a part of too, called No More Lines. And I think we've been so blessed in Arizona to have open enrollment. It's crazy to think that there are still states, there's still people probably listening to this podcast that live in a state where you can't open enroll. You are going to the school that you are zoned for, or you're paying for a private school.
Yeah.
Those are your only choices. And we forget how much this idea of boundaries based on where you live and limiting parents based on their income or their zip code is really a kind of a oppressive way to control these families from having choices. And open enrollment solves all of that. It's a beautiful thing.
I don't think it adds that much inefficiency. I think the net efficiency is an increase because what is that? It's really about student achievement at the end of the day. I'm sorry, you're going to say?
Yeah, when I was going to high school, you had to go to the district school that was right in your neighborhood. And I remember my younger sister applied for a variance and she was going to go to a different school that had less crime and gangs.
Imagine that.
So my younger sister applied for a variance and was able to go to a different high school. And to me, that was like, couldn't even contemplate.
Yeah.
You know, having a choice. When I was in high school, I just went to the high schools down the street. So right. Now it's changed a lot since then.
Amazing.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's dig into ESAs a little bit because that's something you know a lot about. And it, like you said, is really the next wave of school choice, which is pretty exciting. And Arizona here is really on the cutting edge of it. Let's start with what are we learning about this new program, because it is universal in Arizona now.
Yeah.
Tell us some
I'll give
thoughts.
You a little background and information too for people who may not be familiar with ESAs. So ESAs stand for Education Savings Accounts. Arizona's is called the Empowerment Scholarship Account. Okay. Other states maybe have different names, the Hope Scholarship, different things like that. And essentially what it does is it allows families to access the state portion of their child's education funding and to take those dollars wherever they decide is best. In Arizona, our program is 90% of what the state portion is. So we're one of the few states whose ESA program is legislatively designed as a percentage, which I think our program is the best. And I think it's good for your listeners to know too. One of the other reasons why I think it's the best is because we allow families who have a student with a special need or a disability to also access their disability multiplier. So in Arizona,
that's a big deal.
It's a very big deal. And it's very important, especially for students that have severe needs or needs that require more funding for their education, such as students with autism. So in Arizona, our ESA award is around average $7,500 for a student without a disability, but it can go up to $30,000 a year for a student, for example, who has autism. And of course, you can apply in Arizona year round. It doesn't matter what your income is, and your child qualifies all the way up until they graduate. So the most flexible and the most universal.
That's great.
Okay, to back up, you said this bucket, right? So that bucket is funded by our all taxpayers' money, correct? So all the money that the taxpayers submit from Arizona into this bucket, that's where you're saying comes out of and is allocated.
Yep. Every year Arizona does their budget. Around $7.7 billion is allocated towards education. And the Arizona ESA program comes out of that large bucket of funding for students and for their education. And Arizona's program is also unique because those funds can be used to home educate a child as well. So for like a student with a disability, it's really phenomenal because they can take those dollars to pay for tutors and therapists, one-on-one, anything that they think they need for their child's education. And it's actually saving the public school system a lot of burden and responsibility of educating those students who normally had IEPs, who might have had very expensive services that they needed in the public school system, and oftentimes the parents weren't happy with those services. So again, it's a right. win-win for the public schools and the child.
Because when they take one, if I understand correctly, they say, I'm not going to enroll my child in a public school, whether it's district or charter, because we're now going to have that money. And then we're going to do what we think is best with it within the guidelines of the program. And
homeschooling.
It could be homeschooling, yeah.
Could be a private school, yeah. And that's the other thing that's really amazing about the whole supply and demand side of this. So for those who aren't familiar, Arizona's had an ESA program for over 10 years. But the categories of who qualified were limited. It was you had to be switching out of a D or F rated school. You had to be a military family. You had to have a child with an IEP or a 504 plan from the public school. All these categories. And what we saw was the program was very small, and I qualified, my kids qualified back as a student with a disability. We had maybe 7,000 kids in the program in 2018, 2019, but and it was complicated. It was complicated for those parents to qualify with all the guidelines. But when the program went universal, we went from right before 2022, about 12,000 kids at that point in the program, to now there's over 75,000 families on the ESA. So it just really shows you that this is what parents were waiting for. This is what they wanted. This is what they needed, because our program grew so quickly.
You know, you think of a homeschool family, they pay their state taxes, and for decades and decades, they haven't really benefited from it, even though they paid it. And I get the arguments out there of why not, but it's definitely, there are arguments of it's their tax money too.
It's exactly right. And when you stop and think about it, they make the same argument. I love to debunk this myth too about wealthy families. They'll say, well, you know, this wealthy family was already paying for their kid to go to private school. So why should that family get access, for example, to an empowerment scholarship? And I always say, well, when we stop paying more money, right now in Arizona, it's around $12,000 a student for the district public school. When we stop paying for wealthy families to go to the public school system, then we can have a conversation, because nobody thinks about the fact that the state is spending money on, quote, wealthy families all the time to go to public school. But with the ESA, the state's actually saving money, and the parents are getting what they want. And what we're seeing is not only the demand for ESAs is growing, but the beautiful thing about that is now we're going to get to see the supply increase. So an argument that's used a lot, especially it was used in Texas and other places, to say, well, we don't want these ESA programs. We don't even have schools for these kids. We say, well, the supply will follow the demand. Give these parents the opportunity, and we will start to see people enter into the industry of education through unique options, whether it's a private school, a hybrid school. I have two kids right now at a hybrid school.
Oh, interesting.
They started in January. We're loving it. We'll start to see these new, really innovative options, which is great for families. It's great for kids. It's great for our country.
Yeah.
And I was just going to say, for those listeners who don't know what an IEP or a 504 is, those, do you want to explain? Those are just services or categories, kids in categories who have special needs who are getting services from their school.
Yeah.
So it's like a written program. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to explain.
No, I'll share.
My child has a 504, so for ADD, she has ADD. And so I, you know, am familiar with it, but for our listeners who don't know what this lingo is.
Yeah, I love talking about this just really quickly, because most people are unaware of the fact that federal law, it's called federal child fine law, which means that public schools have the responsibility to find and identify students with disabilities where their disability is impacting their education. So if you're listening to this and you have children or you are a grandparent and you're someone in your sphere, coworker says, I think my kid has dyslexia or my kid is struggling with X, Y, and Z. Even if your child is homeschooled, even if your child is enrolled in a private school, no matter what state you are in, you have the legal right to have that child evaluated in the public district school for a disability. If they attend that school, an IEP is written if they attend that school, or potentially a 504 plan, which is just accommodations for that child. If your child's not enrolled in that school, you'll just get a document called an MET, which says, yes, this is a child that has ADHD or dyslexia and it's impacting their education. That's very valuable information for a parent to have, whether you're homeschooling in private school or, of course, enrolled in a district or charter school.
Yeah, it's been extremely helpful just to have some accommodations based on my particular child's need. So I have so much appreciation and encourage parents to get an evaluation if Absolutely. They feel like there's something that's missing Yes. in their child's education.
Don't wait, like, do yeah. it.
Jenny, you talked about a myth. Touch on a couple of other myths that we're hearing in this first couple of years of ESAs, you know, because this is really where we need to separate fact from fictions. We need to keep our heads. And the state, I think, is willing to learn. And where there's issues or ways to improve it, I don't think anybody's really opposed to that.
Yeah.
But I think there's just a lot of noise in the early years. What are another, let's say two other myths that you're hearing?
Perfect. And I'll plug our new website we just launched a couple weeks ago, defendingeducationfreedom.com, okay. because we're starting to specifically address a lot of these myths with Arizona first and then other states by putting articles, reports, and resources on that website. But one of the other big myths, I dealt with it a bunch last night, even on Instagram, is accountability. This kind of vague concept of, well, in the public school system, in a district school, we have real accountability. And what they mean by that is testing. But in the ESA program in Arizona or other states, we really don't have accountability unless these kids are being required to take some sort of state standardized testing. And so I love debunking that myth because I think we've forgotten where true accountability lies. And true accountability lies with the parent. There's nobody that cares more about how my child is doing academically than me. And so this idea that we can't have accountability with these very flexible, innovative ESA programs unless they're submitting to state testing is really false. And the neat thing about ESA programs and accountability is that you can, which I have done before, you can go get as much testing as you want in an ESA program. We're allowed Sure. to pay for any type of standardized testing that we want in the ESA program to find out how our kids are doing. And most of us do that. What we're not doing is saying they have to learn these specific things that meet whatever the state testing requirement is. And so I love talking about the accountability piece because I believe we actually have more accountability on the ESA side. And the other thing I like to say is, okay, you do the state testing as a parent, and at the end of third grade, you find out your kid is not reading proficiently at grade level. In fact, based on Arizona law with Move On When Reading, maybe they're saying your kid's not going to move on because they're not meeting these certain benchmarks. What accountability do you have? Are you going to get money from the school because your child's not reading? Are they going to pay for extra summer programs and tutoring and all? No. So you don't really have accountability as a parent in that system. You can start to go through the special education evaluation process, which I strongly encourage, but you're not able to hold the school accountable if they didn't educate your child. In an ESA program, you can. You can leave, you can switch, you can do something else.
Well, let's not fool ourselves in saying that the state accountability is actually useful.
Yeah. Great
it's
point.
Not.
Great
and
point.
When I was in your seat on the board, I would tell the department, I go, you know, this test is meaningless to the schools mm-hmm. because there's really no data that comes back that's helpful to look at it by strand or by.
That's right.
And so the teachers can't do anything about it. The principals can't do anything about it. Parents get nothing. They get one page that shows effectively cut scores.
Yes. cut scores.
So yes. We spend a ton of money.
We do.
On something completely useless. It's only being done because we have to for federal dollars.
That's right.
This whole accountability myth about state tech, let's just make sure we know that the state testing apparatus, at least in Arizona and maybe in other states, is completely useless to the taxpayer.
Yep.
And if someone wants to challenge me, please bring it on.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I will just say they can use their ESA money to do things that are useful. SAT, ACT.
Yep. CLT.
Yeah. Maybe ASVAB if they're thinking military. You know, they can get tests that are actually useful to them and their progress and their achievement. So that's another thing about accountability that people need to really remember. Do you want to add anything?
I know you owe us another myth if you have one.
Yeah.
To move on. Please.
But then I want to talk about some success stories.
Well, really quickly on the accountability piece, the other thing that we often hear is accountability and they're referring to the test scores, but then they often will say accountability as it relates to spending. So I want to hit on that too as another myth. So there's this idea that, well, you know, because parents who are on the ESA program in Arizona, because it's so flexible and they can buy any curriculum they want, they can do any online educational program, they can buy any textbook they want. You know, that means they might be able to buy a Bible. That means they might be able to buy, you know, some sort of free market economics curriculum that I don't like or that hasn't met state standards or something like that. And they don't like the fact that they feel that parents can purchase whatever they want. So I like to explain to people that the Auditor General in Arizona did a report a couple years ago now that basically said there was less than 0.1% misspending in Arizona's ESA program.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. And I like to say, do we see that same level of misspending in the public school system? No, we do not. And so in the Arizona ESA program, you have to upload a receipt and also a credential if you have a tutor or a therapist, their credential, their license for every single transaction.
Yeah, that's
so
a lot.
So it is a lot. And it's really important to talk about that because I don't think the public is aware of just how accountable on the expense side the program is. Even when you're getting reimbursements, there's eyes on everything and it takes a lot of time to process those things because it's so accountable.
When I got a funny story to tell you about this point, because the presumption that if the government doesn't approve of it, it's not righteous, it's not good.
Correct.
It's not. It doesn't have any efficacy.
It's crazy.
Is silly. It is crazy. Certainly, there's a lot of good time and effort put into some of their recommendations, and we should look at it. I mean, there's. I'm not saying disregard it out of hand, but I remember we had a superintendent from the Navajo Nation come in front of us because we were withholding money from him on English second language programs. Okay, Navajo Nation, 100% of their students are English is a second language. Mm-hmm. Navajo is their primary language. Mm-hmm. And he was in violation because he wasn't using a state board, a government-approved program. And here's what he told us. He stood up and he says, I'm so-and-so. I have a PhD in education from the University of California, Berkeley. And I actually have a specialty in this area. And you can take your money and keep it because what you guys are requiring us to use doesn't work. We tried it. It does not work.
Wow.
It works for people that have a percentage of their population as English as a second language. We have 100%. He goes, here's what we're doing that is working. We are partnering with Stanford University School of Education, and he outlined their program. He goes, and this is actually really great, and it works perfectly for our young people to learn English, and we're just going to stay with it. He goes, I'm not here to poke you in the eye, and I'm not here to make fights. I'm just saying as the superintendent, I'm going to do what's best for my population, not necessarily just what the government is telling me to do. And the state board, we just kind of looked at each other like, how do we bring the hammer to this guy? Because he's doing what we all want him to do. Just because it's not in our board rules or in something. And anyways, we gave him a waiver, which was great.
Which is,
and,
you know,
we wanted to help fund what is working for his population. And so people need to remember that just because it's in writing at some point in time doesn't mean it's the end all. And variation is needed.
Well, and we have to think bigger too. I mean, on my way here, I was on the phone with a mom who said, I saw a story on, you know, this local news station in Arizona, and they were highlighting all these things that ESA parents in Arizona are purchasing with their scholarship. And I said, yeah, so? Because I said our idea of what is educational and what kids need, you could make a list of approved things that, you know, even someone with a PhD in education would say, oh, yep, this is approved. These are educational. And that list would be different by tomorrow. And that's a good thing, because we want a country where kids and our options and our opportunities are changing by the minute, where they are flexible and innovative. And what we think is approved and acceptable can't just be the same old stale stuffy curriculum.
Right. And a list from 15 years ago.
And a list from, we've got to adapt and we've got to innovate. Quick story too. My son started a couple years ago on an online program that started out of SpaceX. And there was a school there for the people that work there. And they spun out a program for kids who didn't go to school there. And it's called Synthesis. And when it first started, you know, real small kind of startup. And I said to my son, who's neurodiverse, dyslexic, all these things, I think that you might really like this. Let's use our ESA to pay for it. He's been on it now almost 4 years. He's going to age out of it because you get to a certain age, you can't do it anymore. And it's teaching kids all these incredible ways to work in teams, work in groups, critical thinking, challenges, all of this kind of stuff. And it didn't exist 5 years ago. And so that's the kind of stuff. And it's a lot of it is like, how are you going to manage a career in space or other things like that? Well, you need to start teaching these kids when they're 8. Not when they're 18. Right. And so these new opportunities that are emerging because of school choice, that's what we're seeing.
Yeah. No, that's great. I love the stories.